Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon, I should say. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradoxes Sunday School class. Dr. Ross is with us today. He'll be speaking on Noah's Flood, fantastic or factual. Next Sunday, Dr. Ross will be here. We think we're meeting in the main sanctuary next week. So don't come here. We'll meet there at 12:15. And on October 12th will be Dr. Mark Clark, going to co-author his new book. It's not published yet, but it's on UFOs and UAPs. He's co-authored with Dr. Ross and Ken Samples of RTB. And those of you who aren't aware, the three of them wrote a book 20-something years ago, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. So there's free ones in the back of the room if you've never gotten one. Great, easy to read book. So we'll see what the new one, when's that new one coming out, Dr. Ross? Pardon me?
One year.
In about a year. But we're getting prepared now. Skeptics Forum. Tony, come on up. Let me say, the date is October 26th, and Tony's going to tell you about the flyers he's been working on.
Can you hold the mic?
Yes.
Hi, folks. Thank you. Thank you for asking me to do this. So I was asked to do it. I think we all have been asked to do it, but I just want to stand up and do it, okay? So I've created a variety of flyers. These two particular, I think, work well. One is very scientific, and one has the creation with Michelangelo's creation. So I think it's very nice, and I also have that in a smaller form, and you'll see a lot more of this. It's the same creation one, but it's small, and then I have some others, okay? They're fun. So these are things I think we can use in the school areas. Now, these smaller ones in particular, I want to use this to target high school age. And we can't get on campus. If you can, if you work on a campus, if you're a teacher or administrator, please take a bunch of them and place them where you can. But in a lot of places, we have what's called a public forum. By one of the major universities here in Los Angeles, one of the most famous universities, across the street, all the students congregate. There are all kinds of stores and restaurants and their apartments. It's just beautiful, okay? And as you walk around, there are tons of things posted everywhere. Well, those are public forums. So I add to the public forum. And there are places I've noticed, you might be very interested in this. You see a post and there's Karl Marx, or there's the American Communist Party, and nobody's challenging it. We can challenge that, okay? So they're trying to capture the intellectuals by placing it there. That's what we need to do too. We need to let the intellectuals know that there are there's the Christian alternative. Thank you, Dr. Ross, for making that alternative so available.
Tony?
Yes, a question.
You mentioned some of the colleges that you've
Okay, yes. I've been to Pasadena City College like three or four times already, and I'll be there again today. There's another university very close by, which I won't mention but the name, but I've been there a couple times, and I've made sure they have this. And I will be attending a lecture there on Thursday, and I will be printing up some tickets. And as I wait in line and as I meet people there, I'll be giving them tickets, like rock and roll tickets to a concert, to come to this event. Okay, now additionally, Pomona, Cal Poly, Pomona, Citrus College.
APU, if you can get in.
I've approached UCLA, USC. Yes, but those colleges, we'll see what we can find in the way of a public forum. And so I've been to like six colleges, and others have done others, okay? And I've noticed that as I return to a college, our material's still there. And I have one that I put like six, and it says take one, and they peel off one, and there's only like one left. So someone's been peeling off, mm-hmm. Okay? So I'm testing it. But I think it's wonderful to get out and really try to reach the young people. And we lost a champion on Christian apologetics about 3 weeks ago. But we have a great champion for Christian apologetics with us right here. So we need to promote our faith, and we need to use all the tools and the saints that God has given us to do that. So I'm here to help you guys, and online folks, we want to have some special things for you too, especially as the time's approaching. Thank you guys.
Thanks, Tony.
You're welcome.
Okay, November 9th, Joey Varese of RTB will be speaking here. He's been here before. He's really excellent. And he hasn't given me the exact subject yet, so we'll wait and see. Nancy.
Yes.
I believe you have something to say up here.
I do.
I'm going to give you the mic, okay?
All right.
Watch your step.
Yeah.
Let's see, are they going to show your slides?
I think they're going to put one up, right? Yeah, okay, hi. So I asked Hugh if I could have a few minutes to talk about something that I did at my church. Now, my church is Lake Avenue in Pasadena. And it turned out to be such a wonderful experience. I thought maybe if I talk to you about it, you might be a little inspired to do this at your church. Okay, so what I did, I went to all the youth groups. I went to the college. We have young adult and we have older young adult. I haven't made it to the high school group yet, but I will be doing that. I decided that I wanted to give a little science faith talk and my testimony because of what studying all this science has done for me. And my husband and I got involved in RTB in 2009, I think. Fell in love with RTB people, all their books, started reading and studying, and we actually taught a class at Lake Avenue with Ross Hoagland. He was a big help. And that's where I met Mark, Tim Wagner, and met just wonderful people. By the way, what? I'm too loud, too soft? Huh? What?
The drive
for
the pictures?
Oh, my flash drive? Yeah. Is it on the table there? I can't remember what I did with it. I probably put it in. Here. It's it's probably. Where did I put it? Oh, the pictures disappeared? There we go. Okay.
Oh.
All right. So what I discovered was that I'm really not a science person. I'm a former English teacher, high school, college counselor. And, you know, my husband, Warren, who I lost a few years ago, he remembered all the science, you know, as did Ross Hoagland, of course. They knew everything. And I just, you know, it wouldn't stick in my brain. But what I discovered and what I wanted to share with the young people at my church is that you don't have to be a science person or a science expert to have the full benefit of studying and knowing some science. I realized that my faith was so strengthened just by going to Hugh's class and reading the books. And even though I didn't absorb it all and I didn't remember it all, my understanding of who God was and his power and his glory, it just made a huge difference in my life. So that's what I wanted to share with the young people in my church. Now, I'm a former teacher, so of course I have handouts. So I gave them a couple things I'm just going to review quickly. I said to them, if you can just keep in mind the complexity of the cell's design, and keep in mind fine-tuning, that's going to give you so much confidence. So I don't even know where I got this thing. This is about the cell and all, you know, a dozen different machineries. And then on the back, I had this amazing facts about the body and brain. But what I said to them was, the one thing about the cell I want you to remember, nothing complex, there's 3.4 billion letter sequence, ACGT or something like that, in every one of your 40 trillion cells in your body. Now, if someone's going to say, oh, this is all unguided, undirected process, there's no God. Really? 3.4 billion letter sequence in every cell in your body, and you're going to say, oh, it's just random. It just happened. I think that's a bit of a stretch. So I just went over stuff like that with them. Like, there are 40,000 lipids in the cell membrane. Okay. In each cell, a total of 75,000 enzymes are all thrown together. Again, you're going to say, oh, that just happened. That's just random. It's just unguided, undirected process. I think that's a stretch. So we talked about that. And then I talked about fine-tuning. Now, you all know about fine-tuning. We don't have to go over that. But what I said to them was, think of it like knobs. You know, it used to be maybe 20 or so, and then it got up to 200. I got this from Hugh a few years ago. I don't know when. 2008. They were already up to 200. And now Hugh says there are up to 2,000 fundamental constants in the universe. So if you think of it like little dials, you know, they have to be just precisely set. And you're going to say, oh, it's 2,000 dials, and it's just unguided, undirected process. It just happened randomly. So I just encourage them to think about those two things, cell design and fine-tuning. Keep that in their head to give them boldness and give them confidence in engaging with other people who say, oh, you know, there is no God. So my challenge to you is, why don't you do that at your church? It takes very little time. I made wonderful friends. As a matter of fact, I think I have a picture here. This is from the gala last Saturday. I brought a whole bunch of young adults, and we had such a great time. And they really didn't know much about RTB. They, you know, I had gone and talked to them and encouraged them to come, and they came. They were blown away by everything that RTB does for the Lord throughout the whole world. So I would love to see this expand to all kinds of youth groups. And for those of you online, I challenge you too. Why not do something like this? Go to your youth groups and just talk. You know, don't make it complicated, make it personal. And I've seen the effect in the lives of these young people. So I just wanted to go a few more pictures. Why don't you guys just run through? By the way, in the sound booth back there is Tim Wagner and Jamie Campbell. And we need to thank them because they work so hard. Absolutely. Here every week, making sure we have the sound and visual, and it's a lot of hard work. So thank you guys. Now, let's just, okay, so here are just some pictures. Just run through them. I wanted you to see, oh, there's some more of my kids. They were amazing young people, just wonderful. And there's Kathy, and there's Fuzz and Amy, the president. Now, this is what I wanted you to see. This is where we met in the aquarium. And we had all kinds of tables and lots of people. We raised a lot of money, praise God for that. But it was just an amazing night that impacted so many lives. So I just wanted you to see some pictures. Okay, that's it. I'm challenging you all, get out and do it, okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. That was great. I'd like to get a copy of that sheet you had.
I left some copies over there.
Okay.
This is over there in case you want to use them.
Okay. And let's see. Well, let me pray and we'll get Dr. Ross up here. So bow your heads, please. Eternal Father, please bless our Paradox's message today and bless the messenger. Bless us, the audience. Help us to gain knowledge of your special and general revelations for our witnessing efforts. In Jesus' name we ask this. Amen. Dr. Ross, come on up.
Well, thank you for that encouragement. And again, I'd like to add to what you were just saying, Nancy, and that is when we've done skeptics forums in the past, we've gotten our most challenging questions from children and youth. So hey, I think part of our outreach, talk to parents, talk to grandparents and say, if you've got someone who's asking precocious questions, bring them here to the skeptics forum. And thank you too, Nancy, for encouraging our people online. People that are online, if you know someone that's got questions, challenging questions, encourage them to be part of it. A lot of people think if you're online, it's passive. We don't do that. We invite the people that are participating online to deal, engage us with their questions and discussions. And we do the Skeptics Forums. We're going to do it as we do the Q&A here every week. We're going to alternate between people that are here in person and people that are online. So if you got someone who's got questions, but they say, hey, I'm not going to make the trip over to Pritchard Hall, they can participate online. Okay, believe it or not, we're at the point of almost wrapping up our series on the flood. I think two or three more Sundays we're going to be done. I'm going to try to get it done in two Sundays. And yes, this book, Noah's Flood Revisited, it's going to be released October 7th. And that gala, we actually gave away a few advanced copies. But I have a whole chapter in the book on what I call fantastic elements. And what's been happening is that leading conservative theologians and pastors have been basically making the argument we can't take the story of Noah's flood in the book of Genesis historically or literally because it's filled with fantastic elements. And therefore, they're exhorting us to actually read the Genesis account as an allegory for salvation and baptism only. Not to see it as something that's a literal, true story. So Noah's flood, is it really fantastic or is it factual? And it was the theologian William Lane Craig who defined what he meant by a fantastic element. He defined it as an event or a component that cannot possibly be true if understood literally. And so he rejects the idea that the account of Noah's flood is a literal, true historical account because it says he's filled with he identifies 10 fantastic elements. Now we dealt with some of these already, and so I'm going to give you the ones we dealt with, and we're going to dive into the ones we've not dealt with. And so one of them, as they say, the flood extent. It can't be extensive enough to wipe out all of humanity. And we've been talking about, well, if we correctly date the time of Noah's flood, it dates back to a time when humanity had not become globally distributed. In fact, they were constrained to the near Middle East, maybe parts of Eastern Africa, but that's it. And we have the flood dating back into the last ice age, and which indeed is impossible to flood that region to a sufficient extent where you wipe out all of humanity and all the animals associated with them. The second fantastic element that's identified by 21st century theologians, They say the story of Tower of Babel and the rapid global colonization simply can't be true. Well, it can't be true if you claim that Noah's flood dates back, say, 5,000, 6,000 years ago. But as we point out in our class here, we now have the scientific tools to date when humans rapidly migrated out of the Near and Middle East into all the parts of Africa, Europe, Asia, Australia. And how, once we understand that that happened, you know, 42 to 49,000 years ago, that puts Noah's flood before that. And now, and I purposely waited to bring out this book until we had indisputable scientific dating by four independent methods that make the point. And so this no longer is a fantastic element. And what about the animals? Well, a couple of weeks ago, we went through the seven different Hebrew words used for the animals that were wiped out by Noah's flood, and likewise the animals that Noah had rescued on board the ark. And I realize these are the animals that are soulish in nature, animals endowed by God with mind, will, and emotions. These are the animals that can relate to human beings. These are the animals that we tame to do our bidding. And as we go through the different examples of God judging human reprobate behavior, we learn that the only animals that can be damaged by human reprobate sin are the soulish animals that are in relationship with humans. And so if a very wicked person has a couple of pet dogs, those dogs are designed by God to please their human owners, and what brings pleasure to the human owners is vicious behavior. Guess how the dogs will behave. But that doesn't work for, say, houseflies or cockroaches or salamanders. They can't form relationships with us, so they can't be damaged by human sin unless the human reprobate steps on them and kills them, in which case there's no need for the flood to wipe them out. They're already dead. And then we dealt with, well, people claiming there's no way humans could build a wooden boat that's 450 feet long. And last week we talked about how that indeed can be done, recognizing that the God tells Noah, look, not any old wood will do. You must build it out of gopher wood. And if you remember, we went through the five different kinds of softwoods that the Bible mentions, the 21 different kinds of hardwoods, and the fact that the Bible is so exhaustive in mentioning specific kinds of hardwoods tells us this gopher wood must be in a category distinct from the 21. And some of those 21, like for example, acacia wood, indeed would be strong enough. It has a strength index that's adequate to build a boat entirely out of wood that's 450 feet long. But gopher wood would be, because it's not identified specifically, we can imply that it's a wood that's even has a stronger strength index than even acacia wood. And we mentioned, hey, there would have been a half dozen different kinds of timbers in that region that Noah could have exploited to build the ark. Also explains why we don't find the remains of Noah's ark. That gopher wood would have been so valuable, there's no way people would have left that wood just to sit there out in the open. After the flood was over, the ark would have been dismantled by people in their building projects because of the high value of that gopher wood. So we don't expect to find the remains of Noah's ark. And the other one we dealt with was vegetarianism. Now, I would argue and agree with theologians, there's no way that people living before the flood were on a strict vegetarian diet. Well, I think some of them were, because God told Adam and Eve, hey, you need to be on a vegetarian diet. And what he tells Noah is, look, I forbade you from eating meat before the flood, but now, after the flood, I'm going to give you permission to have a broad diet. You can eat meat. However, I do agree with theologians. Given the wickedness of Noah's compatriots, chances are a lot of them were violating God's command to simply only eat a vegetarian diet. Many of them probably were violating that, and hence not all people would have been on a vegetarian diet. But I think people like Noah and their family and others who were obeying God would indeed be on a vegetarian diet. So those are the five fantastic elements we've already dealt with in this class. I'm now going to talk about five we've not yet dealt with. And one of them is related to vegetarianism. And so we have theologians saying, hey, if we actually read the early chapters of Genesis literally, it actually says that people living before the flood were able to live 700 years, 800 years. You got Methuselah living 969 years. Adam lived 930 years. And they say there's no way if we take that literally that can possibly be true. And so what you see theologians saying, well, maybe in the days before the flood, they didn't have a decimal number system like we do today. They had some other kind of system. So they argue, for example, maybe their base was 60 and not 10. And so they argue, well, in that case, we can divide that 969 by 6 years. And maybe they used an 88 base system. So they have ways of trying to figure it all out. But one reason why I would argue that that's not a solution to what you see in Scripture is, notice Scripture not only gives you exact numbers for how long they live. Now, it'd be one thing to say, well, those ages are hyperboles. A number of well-known fact, one of the theologians that makes that argument, I'm going to be debating him in November at the Evangelical Theological Society. And he says, hey, this has to be a hyperbole. But I would argue that if it's a hyperbole, we shouldn't see the ages given to three significant figures. You know, the analogy I think we used 2 weeks ago is, it's one thing to say, my briefcase over there weighs a ton. You know, if I pick it up, it feels like it weighs a ton. But if you were to weigh it, you would realize it doesn't weigh a ton. It only weighs 27.6 pounds. And if I told you it weighed 27.6 pounds, you would understand that as something that's literal, not as an hyperbole. But notice what you see in the early chapters of Genesis. It not only gives the ages of these patriarchs to two or three places of the decimal, it also gives you the age they were when they had their firstborn son. And notice those are given, not just to a round off of one figure, hey, roughly 40 years, you get an exact number, 23 years, 49 years, 51 years, and so. And if you're going to divide that by 10 to try to make things consistent with the lifespan, saying, well, I mean, we're going to have Methuselah actually living as long as the Bible says. We use a number system, and so he really didn't die at 969. If we use a 100 base number system, he really died at 96.9 years. But now you've got a problem. His firstborn son now becomes born when he's 5 or 6 years of age. And you know, that's really not realistic that a 5 or 6 year old boy could give birth to a son. So these are all arguments that really is intended to be taken literally. So how do we deal with this? Is it really possible to interpret this literally and true? Okay, some other ones, I'm going to get to that in a minute, but some of the ones we're going to look at is language diversification. So you got theologians claiming there's no way all the languages of today could be derived from a single language that's being spoken in days before the flood. Well, again, I would argue, yes, you got a point if you're dating the flood be 5 or 6,000 years ago. That's not enough time to get thousands of languages. But if you put it back early enough, I don't think you run into a problem. Likewise, they say it's impossible to get 8 billion people from just 8 individuals that are on board Noah's Ark. Again, you got a point if you're dating the flood at 5 to 6,000 years ago. But if you're dating it at 60 to 90,000 years ago, you don't run into a problem, nor do you run into a problem with the genetic diversity. This is one of the strongest arguments I see in books written by theologians that discount the Genesis flood as a literal historical account. They say there's no way you can explain the genetic diversity of present-day humans coming from just eight people that were on board Noah's Ark. Again, you got a point if you're putting the flood 5,000 to 10,000 years ago, but if you're putting it back 60,000 to 90,000 years, no problem. And then what about the resting place of the ark? They say, there's a problem here. You got this flood covering huge sections of the near Middle East, but we all know that water runs downhill. And if it runs downhill, it's gonna take the ark with it. After all, the ark didn't have sails. It didn't have oars. So you couldn't have Noah and his family with their oars trying to push the ark uphill. And by the way, given the size of the ark, that wasn't gonna work anyway. You know, any of you who've been in a canoe or a kayak in a river, you know, it's hard going against the current. It's quite easy just to let the current carry you out into the ocean. So how do you get the ark resting on Mount Ararat when the ark should have flown out into the Indian Ocean? Okay, let's go back to the long lifespans. And I want to begin with, well, how long can people live today? I mean, as I look at this audience, some of you are young, some of you are old. I'm probably the oldest person here. However, there are a lot of people in the world who are a whole lot older than I am. The oldest person that has ever lived is a French woman by the name of Jeanne Calment, who died at an age of 122. However, that age is disputed. A lot of people think it was her daughter after she died that basically claimed to be the mother. And so Jeanne really didn't live to be 122 years old. And there's a debate about, okay, whose birth certificate is whose. And so this is disputed. But I'm going to give you the names of some individuals for whom there is no dispute. And one is a Japanese woman. Her name is Kane Tanaka. She made it to 119. Okay. Sarah Noss. She also made it to 119 years. Lucille Randon. She made it to 118 years, European. And this woman was alive until just a couple of weeks ago. Maria Branyas, she lived to be 117. So if you look her up online, she'll say she's the oldest living, currently alive woman, but I got news for you. She died just a few days ago, but she made it to 117. Now, for all you guys in the audience, I want you to notice, there are no men here. They're all women. Women tend to live longer than men. But hey, there is a man on the list. And so of the five oldest undisputed people who have lived the longest, Jeromen Kimura, a Japanese man, he made it to 116 years. So all you guys in the audience, there's hope. Live your lives the right way, you might be able to live 116 years. What's interesting about this list, what you see in Genesis chapter 6, verse 3, is where God says, okay, in the days before the flood, I made it possible for you humans to live 800, 900, even 969 years. That's not going to be the case anymore. I'm going to shorten the maximum lifespan of humanity down to 120 years. And so this list basically documents, hey, what the Bible declared in Genesis 6:3 really does look to be correct, that the maximum lifespan of humans is 120 years. Now, if you look at Genesis chapter 11, it gives a genealogy that runs from Noah down to Abraham, and you notice that the ages run from 950 for Abraham, and they decline down to about 175 years for Abraham. And you see kind of an exponential decline. That's a clue as to what's going on, as to how the lifespans indeed were shortened if we take the text literally. But this little particular list here basically demonstrates, hey, when the Bible says 120 years, it really is 120 years. Now, I did notice it didn't say 120 years and 3 months. It basically said 120 years, which tells me, hey, if we actually have somebody making it to 122 years, that doesn't violate what Genesis 6:3. 120 years, that's two significant figures. So I would interpret that, hey, the maximum lifespan for humanity is 120 plus or minus 5 years. But maybe it is significant to three places of the decimal. If it is, this list says, hey, still holds out. Nobody makes it past 120 plus or minus 1 year. So whether you round it off to three places of the decimal or two places of the decimal, it still stands. Now, again, if you go online, you'll see claims that people living in the 18th and 19th century live longer than the biblical 120. But there's no paper trail to document that that's actually true, where you actually have a birth certificate and a death certificate. So what we see here, with the exception of Jean Calment, in every case, we have an undisputed birth certificate and an undisputed death certificate showing that they really did live that long. Now, how many of you here in the audience would like to live a longer life than the average for humanity? I think here in America, the average now is like 79 years. Although for those of you that are alive here in the audience, if you're alive in this class right now, your life expectancy is more than 79 years. Because a lot of people die in childbirth, a lot of people have childhood, and since you made it past childhood, you're gonna be living into your 80s. And so people that have made it past childhood, your real life expectancy is somewhere in the low to mid 80s. And yes, just like this list indicates, women tend to live longer than men. Although what's been noticing in the latest literature on longevity, the gap between how long women live and how men live, it's getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And they actually document why they think that is the case, is that it used to be that in terms of people who smoked all their life, it was predominantly men as opposed to women. And how if you take the smoking factor out, men and women tend to live about the same. Well, there's a little difference of a few months. Okay, now, in the case of these five that are at the bottom of this list, there have been scientific papers published saying, you know, is there something we can learn from these people that can help us live longer lives? Okay, here's what they notice. Number one, they all have short telomeres. They all have an exceptionally healthy microbiome, excellent blood lipid numbers, very low triglycerides, extremely low inflammation, and all their lives they engage in high physical, mental, and social exercise. Okay, what are telomeres? Look at your shoelaces. Your shoelaces have aglets on them. Those are those little plastic things at the end of your shoelace. They're designed to make sure your shoelaces don't unravel and your shoelaces become shorter and shorter. Well, we actually have telomeres on our chromosomes. You've got one at each end. But the human body is designed in such a way that the older you get, the shorter your chromosomes become. And that ensures you're not going to live past 120. Okay? And so as your chromosomes get shorter and shorter, eventually they get so short that you die. But what's interesting is that people who live the longest, what they notice is they have shorter chromosomes than the rest of the population. And a paper published just a few weeks ago basically pointed out why. Okay, if your chromosomes get shorter and shorter at a more rapid rate than the rest of the population, that gives you a defense against cancer. Because what is cancer? Cancer are cells multiplying out of control. But if the chromosomes are getting shorter and shorter, that acts as a check against cancer. And that's what they notice, is these people lived 116 to 119 years, no evidence of cancer in their lifespan. And that's because they tend to have short telomeres but because of their short telomeres, it explains why they didn't make it past 120 years. Okay. Number two, they got a very healthy microbiome. One of the photos that I saw that you showed, Nancy, showed our visiting scholar who was with us this past week, Jim Painter. Jim Painter has a PhD in medical science, as well as nutrition and diet, and he gave us several lectures last week basically saying, hey, if you want to have a healthy life and live a long time, you need to feed your microbiome. In fact, you made the comment that we have about 1 trillion cells in our body. Well, in addition to the trillion cells that make up your human body, you have a little more than 1 trillion bacteria in your body. So we're basically a walking zoo of bacteria. Now, most of that bacteria is in your gut. You say, wait a minute, you mean we got as many bacteria in our body as we have cells? Yes, you do. But your body cells tend to be big, the bacteria tend to be small, and almost all of them are in your colon and with a little bit in your small intestine. The microbiome basically keeps your internal organs healthy. And so he was giving his lectures on what to do to keep your microbiome. You know, certain probiotics help. Make sure you eat lots of fiber, because these bacteria feed in fiber. That's what keeps them healthy. And there's actually new medical treatments now where they find somebody who's got a really healthy microbiome and someone who doesn't, and they actually transplant some of the material in the colon into the colon of people who don't have a healthy biome. So you can donate if you want, okay? And then these people have excellent blood lipid numbers. I'm talking about cholesterol. The thing that astounded me is these people who live past 100 years, they have extremely low VDL and very high HDL. Say, what's VDL? Well, you've probably heard of LDL. You know, that's the low cholesterol. VDL, I mean, if you go to the doctor, he'll do a blood test on you, and you get the number for, you know, your HDL, LDL, and VDL. Most people don't pay attention to the VDL, typically because there's not a whole lot you can do about it, but that's the very bad cholesterol. And you have excellent health if your VDL level is, say, a 20 to 25. But these people, it's down at 1, an unheard of low number, and they believe that that's genetic. But it's also partly dietary. They have very low triglycerides. What they discovered is these people don't eat any sugar products at all. So no artificial sugar. They don't eat white bread. They don't eat white rice, so that they keep that low. They have extremely low inflammation. The older you get, the more inflammation you have. These people, 110 years of age, they have a difficulty measuring any inflammation in their body. So they don't struggle with arthritis. And they have this, and again, they say that's mainly genetic. The one thing they found that's something that we all can put into order is every one of these people that lived past 110, they had a lifestyle of daily high physical activity, mental activity, and social activity. And they discovered, for example, like my son's a clinical neuropsychologist, and he says, if you want to stave off dementia, make sure you have plentiful social engagement, that you're surrounded by relatives and friends that you have daily social contact with. In fact, I met a woman who had Alzheimer's, and she got involved in this facility. And what they did with her is they had her do an hour of physical exercise every day, an hour of mental exercise every day, and 4 hours of social engagement every day. Over a 10-year period, zero advance in her dementia. You couldn't tell any difference. But hey, she had to invest 6 hours to make that happen. Okay, so how do we go about actually making it possible for people to live 800 or 900 years, and why is it not possible to live that long today? Well, number one, we have a different telomerase activity level. If you're going to live to be 800 or 900 years, your chromosomes can't be getting shorter and shorter at such a rapid rate. However, if we had our chromosomes not getting shorter and shorter at the rate they do, we'd all be dying from cancers at a much earlier age. Which is a clue. There must have been something in the days before the flood where people were not at risk of cancer to the degree they are today. And if they're not at risk of cancer to the degree we are today, there's no need for our chromosomes to get shorter and shorter at such a rapid rate. We can have them getting shorter at a much slower rate than they normally do. Well, this is something I did some research on, literally starting a couple of decades ago, is that there are two astronomers, a British astronomer and a Russian astronomer, that have been teamed up for the last 40 years studying cosmic rays. And beginning 40 years ago, they started publishing papers in which they pointed out that people at a particular time were experiencing fewer deadly cosmic rays than they are today. And what they've been researching is they looked at the cosmic ray spectrum and they found what they call an anomaly in that spectrum, what they refer to as an E, but it indicates that there was a recent supernova eruption, recent in human history, close enough to the Earth that it showered the Earth with cosmic rays that were not a problem before that moment. So you got a supernova eruption exploding. A supernova is a supergiant star that burns up its nuclear fuel, undergoes gravitational collapse, explodes, and showers interstellar space with cosmic rays. What are those cosmic rays? Well, protons, neutrons, electrons, and then you get things like helium nuclei. But the really big supernova actually produce cosmic rays that are oxygen nuclei, neon nuclei, iron nuclei, all the way up to uranium nuclei. And the heavier the cosmic ray, the more damage it does when it strikes your body. The faster it moves, the more damage it does. Well, what these two astronomers, Wolfendale and Oerlikon, basically were able to demonstrate in the research, 95% of the heavy element, fast-moving cosmic rays that we experience come from a single supernova eruption that erupted sometime in the last 100,000 years, relatively close to where we are today. And they spent the last 40 years trying to identify that supernova that was responsible for all these killer cosmic rays and trying to come up with a more accurate date of when it exploded. And hey, if we can come up with an accurate date that's consistent with the date that we've already established for Noah's flood, maybe they'll give us a more accurate date for when Noah lived, but would actually give some, way of determining, is indeed this the primary reason why our lifespans are shorter? Well, the best they've been able to do is to say that the supernova exploded between 20,000 and 100,000 years ago. So what's that? That's 60,000 plus or minus 40,000? Date I think is appropriate for Noah's flood. A very conservative date would be somewhere between, say, 55,000 years ago, 110,000 years ago, although I'd argue a more appropriate date is 60 to 90,000 years ago. But notice that 60 to 90,000 or 55 to 110,000, that's consistent with 20 to 100,000. And you say, well, is there any chance they're going to be able to come up with a more accurate date? There is, so they can accurately identify the supernova remnant. Because when a star undergoes a supernova explosion, it pours out this cloud of gas and dust. And the cloud of gas and dust expands. And so if you can actually identify the remnant of that supernova eruption And the rate with which that remnant's getting bigger and bigger, you can come up with an approximate date for when it exploded. So yes, they've been spending the last 40 years trying to identify it. For a long time, they thought the Vela supernova was the one that shortened our human lifespans or caused all these deadly cosmic rays. They're now claiming that it's a remnant that's in the constellation Monoceros. That's about 25 degrees across, but it's very difficult to detect, and they've yet to be able to come up with an accurate measurement of how rapidly it is expanding. But we do know that 95% of the fast-moving heavy nuclei cosmic rays come from a relatively recent supernova eruption. And so the point is, people living before that supernova wouldn't be exposed to those cosmic rays. People living after that supernova would be exposed to those cosmic rays. Now you might be wondering, well, if I can find some way of protecting myself from those cosmic rays, will I be able to live longer? Well, it is true that people who are more exposed to cosmic rays tend to have a shorter lifespan. So for example, I've got relatives that live in the Denver, Colorado area, which is, you know, a mile high, which means they get exposed to more cosmic rays. And research has been done showing that if you've got people that are living equally healthy lifestyles, one at sea level and one in Denver, the people living in Denver will die 3 months sooner than the people living at sea level. So it doesn't make that much of a difference. But if you got 95% of the killer cosmic rays not impacting your body, that can make a huge difference in how long you could actually live. Okay, I see that I'm over time here, so I'm going to go down the igneous rock. So let me just finish this up so we can get through this faster next week. Okay. There is a way you can escape these cosmic rays, but it's not pleasant. The way to escape those cosmic rays is live your entire life underground. And about 10 feet underground, that will guarantee you're not going to be exposed to cosmic rays of a level that's going to impact your lifespan. But it's going to make it hard for you to socially engage other people if you're spending your entire life 10 feet underground or more. And hey, if you're not socially engaged, that's going to impact your lifespan. Moreover, you might find yourself getting anxious and depressed because they've done experiments where they put people in a capsule and don't let them out. They do not tend to do too well in terms of their mental health, and that will impact your lifespan. So, but there's another problem. If you do live underground, you're going to be exposed to more radiation from the rocks that are there underground. And so a second source of radiation is igneous rocks. And you say, well, what's the difference? Think of granite, think of the mountains that surround here, us here in Los Angeles. California is almost entirely igneous rocks. And igneous rocks, as opposed to sedimentary rocks, have a lot more radioisotopes in them. Here's a list of the radioisotopes. And by the way, every time you drive a freeway, you're driving over igneous rocks. And so as you're driving the freeway, you're getting exposed to all these radioisotopes. And the radioactive decay of these isotopes will do damage to your body. In fact, if you've got a granite kitchen top, they actually advise you test for radon because the radium in that granite top could be radiating this radon, and that could do damage to you. And if you spend a lot of time in your kitchen over a number of years, that can actually shorten your lifespan. So you say, well, maybe I could live longer if I just avoid exposure to igneous rocks. So I'm going to make sure there's no granite in my home. But hey, any concrete in your area is going to be a problem. As I said, freeways are going to be a problem. Asphalt's going to be a problem. It's really very challenging to escape igneous rocks today. However, if you've got humans living entirely within sedimentary plains, without technology, without highways, without concrete skyscrapers, they would be exposed to a whole lot less radiation from the radioisotopes in these decaying. So that's kind of the scenario. You've got people living in sedimentary plains without high technology, without these advanced transportation systems or buildings. They will be exposed to a lot less damage from the decay of radioisotopes in Earth's rocks. And if they're living before that supernova eruption, they'll be exposed to a lot less radiation. But they would need to also be sorry about this. Here we go. Okay. They would need to be, next one. Okay. If they're living at the right time, they're not going to be exposed to these deadly cosmic rays. And if they're living in the right location, they won't be exposed to radioactive decay from these radioisotopes and igneous rocks. And if they obey God's command to be in a vegetarian diet, they could live longer. You're not going to live a long time if you're eating a lot of meat. When you're eating meat, you're concentrating heavy elements. And so when animals eat vegetables, they're basically concentrating the heavy elements that are there. By the way, even when you eat vegetables, you are consuming uranium and thorium and potassium 40. Especially if you live here in California, you're consuming a little extra uranium and thorium. However, if you're eating beef, you're going to be consuming about 500 times as much uranium and thorium than if you're eating spinach. And so one reason why God said, hey, I want you on a vegetarian diet, he was aware that if people were eating meat, and especially certain kinds of meat, they'd be accumulating heavy elements at a much higher rate. And hey, if you're only going to live to be 120, don't worry about eating meat. But if you want to live to be 900, meat's going to be a problem. So I'm not advocating a vegetarian diet, although it might be wise to eat more vegetables and less meat because of the problems that's going to cause for other health issues. Stress. You're going to need a whole lot less stress. But again, if you've got people living in a region where there's not a lot of technology, you don't have to spend 25 years in school and college to get ready for your career, maybe you could actually have a lifestyle where there's a whole lot less stress. And that's one thing that they found in these people that lived past 110, they had a lifestyle of low stress. Stress will kill you if you get too much of it. By the way, you need some stress. People who have zero stress in their life or very little stress, they don't live as long. You need a little bit of stress to stimulate your immune system, but a little goes a long way. And then you need more aerobic physical exercise, and you need less aggressive telomerase activity, which means something supernatural had to happen at the time of Noah's flood, because before Noah's flood, the telomerase, the chromosomes were getting shorter and shorter at a very slow rate in order to make it possible for people to live as much as 120 years after the flood, it's necessary that the chromosomes get shorter and shorter at a more aggressive rate. Therefore, in order to sustain the doctrine that people were living that long, you really would need for people to have their chromosomes getting shorter at a more rapid rate. Hey, I'm way over time. I'm going to stop there. We'll pick this up next week. But hey, let's go to Q&A, take any question you have, and we already have somebody from the online audience that's got a question.
Line questions. Roger Raymer, with all due respect to him, why would astrophysicist Dr. Jason Lyle promote certain aberrant ideas through, I believe, ICR now?
Yeah, I've debated Jason Lyle three times now, and he's an astrophysicist like I am. But he was raised in a young earth environment, and to this day still holds to a young earth view. But if you read his PhD thesis, it's basically written on the assumption that the universe is billions of years old. He's not alone. I've also debated, at least on two occasions, Danny Faulkner. He's a stellar astrophysicist, studies stars. He too was raised in a young earth creationist environment, but looking at his thesis, yes, it's basically assuming that the universe is billions of years old. Both Danny and Jason Lyle kept their young earth beliefs a secret while they were getting their PhD. Only after they got their doctorate did they admit that they were young earth creationists, which definitely has disturbed the professors that granted them their doctoral degrees. But having taught them, they said there's no way they could have gotten a doctoral degree unless they kept their young earth beliefs a secret. Now, both of them take the position that the Bible is crystal clear that the universe is less than 10,000 years old. They said this is the word of God, and therefore we have to force fit science to fit what the Bible teaches. And in debating them, I basically took the view, well, having read the Bible and taking it literally and consistently, I see that it's an old earth book, not a young earth book. Mm-hmm. In fact, I actually argued, hey, if you uphold the doctrine of biblical inerrancy, it's impossible to read the Bible from a young earth perspective. So it's not just the science, it's the Bible that argues against a young earth position. But Jason Lyle is probably best known for claiming, you know, there is a way that light could get from distant quasars and galaxies to the Earth in just thousands of years. He claims that the velocity of light travels at an infinite velocity towards the Earth and at half the velocity of light away from the Earth, making the point that when we measure the velocity of light, we're measuring the return path, not the one-way path. So he hypothesizes that is moving at an infinite velocity towards us. Now, I used to think that he held the position, well, it's infinite traveling towards the center of the Earth, and it travels at less than that velocity in other places. But what happened in a future debate, he was aware, well, now we've got telescopes not only on the Earth, we've got a telescope a million miles away from the Earth. So he's changed his position. We also have supernova that have erupted in distant galaxies and where the light gets gravitationally bent by different angles. So for example, there's a supernova. And by the way, when stars go supernova, you get one explosion only. But there's one supernova where we've seen it explode three different times because it was in a distant galaxy. And as it traveled through space, the light got bent by massive objects between us and that distant galaxy, which caused the light path of the supernova eruption to travel along a different angle in different ways. So we actually saw the supernova erupt at three different times over a three-year period. But in my latest debate with Jason, he's basically saying, well, I think the velocity of light is infinite, no matter where the observer is, no matter what the light path. And it's at half the velocity of light in other ways. But I look at that as being completely ad hoc. You're basically saying it doesn't matter what path it takes, whether it's straight towards you or angled away or towards the Earth or towards the James Webb Space Telescope. It's infinite to all observers, and it's even infinite towards a simple instrument, as opposed to a human observer. And the analogy I've used without much success is, well, I could actually claim that when you look at me, I'm really not 80 years of age, I'm only 5 years of age. And that, you know, what you see on me is simply the appearance of age. And I've actually fooled myself. All these memories I have of the life that I've lived these past few decades, that was all put into my head just 5 minutes ago. I'm really only 5 minutes old. All those memories in my brain were implanted there. And this is what I mean by ad hoc. You're making an assumption with zero evidence of its truth, and it's inconsistent with everything else we observe. However, You know, I don't know everything. Something like that could be true. It's similar to what I've said about my wife. Maybe she doesn't really exist. Maybe I've been fooled these past 48 years by a sophisticated hologram. However, the way you check this is to say, okay, this is the assumption you're making, that this kind of strange speculation without any evidence is really the explanation for why the universe is thousands of years old and not billions of years old. How does the science support that view with respect to time? And what you notice is the scientific evidence for the universe being 13.8 billion years old gets progressively stronger and stronger as we learn more and more about the universe, and the evidence for it being thousands of years old gets progressively weaker and weaker. Likewise, I can share with you the evidence I have for the reality of the physical existence of my wife has gotten stronger and stronger over the 48 years we've been married. It's never gotten weaker and weaker. So I think I'm justified in concluding my wife really does physically exist. Likewise, I'm justified in saying that the universe really is billions of years old. I gave a scientific argument. I could also give a biblical argument. The more we learn and understand about the biblical creation text, the stronger case we get that indeed the Bible is an old earth book, not a young earth book. By the way, several of these debates I've had are public, and you can watch them at your leisure and draw your own conclusions.
Okay. Joe Gazzia, in a recent interview, Dr. Rob Carter argues that mitochondrial Eve is 6,000 years old based on the current mutation rate, which is one mutation every 5 to 10 generations. The atheistic model has Eve at 200,000 years, which he argues is way too low. I believe you argue for 50,000 year Eve. Why should we think the mutation rate is less than it is now?
Okay, good question. We actually covered that, I think, about a month ago in this class, where we looked at four different ways that you can look at the mitochondrial DNA. And for those of you that are not familiar, all of us in this audience get our mitochondrial DNA from our mothers. Your father makes a zero contribution to your mitochondrial DNA. And so what people do is they look at the diversity of mitochondrial DNA in the human population and try to trace back how far back you'd have to go or all descended from one woman. And as the questioner pointed out, one technique is to say, well, let's measure the mutation rate that we see of mitochondrial DNA and presume that rate has never changed, and we can get back to the first woman from whom we're all descended. And if you assume a very high mutation rate, you can get a date as recent as 6 to 10,000 years ago. But the published papers where they're looking at mitochondrial DNA in the peer-reviewed literature, none of them give a date as recent as 6 to 10,000 years ago. They all make the point that mutation rates change. They change over time. For example, if you're in a high radiation area, your mutation rate's going to be higher. If you're living in a high stress environment, it's going to be higher. And so you could actually argue, well, modern high technology science is accelerating the mutation rate, and it's incorrect to assume that that's been the case for humanity all the way back to Adam and Eve. It might be different. And the environment might be different. Where you live can make a difference. We just made the point that early humans were living in sedimentary plains, where again, we'd anticipate a lower mutation rate. So people doing these studies basically try to estimate what was that mutation rate in different geographical regions at different times in human history, and use that to try to determine a date for when we'd all be descended from one woman. And the questioner made the point that, hey, what you see in the secular literature is 200,000 years ago. Well, if you were here a month ago, we made the point that the dates range between about 94,000 years ago and 196,000 years ago. So if you were to round off that 196, you get 200, but that's the farthest back you get using this technique, you actually get dates as recent as 94,000 years ago. And there's big error bars. So the 94 is plus or minus 30,000 years, which means you could actually get it as early as 64,000, recent as 64,000 years ago. So, and given the ways that they're trying to estimate these mutation rates, you get a significant error. However, as we mentioned a month ago, that's one of three different methods we have for determining the rate at which the mitochondrial DNA changes. Not only is there a mutation rate, you can actually look at disequilibrium within the mitochondrial DNA. We can also look at Y chromosome DNA. Now, Y chromosome DNA is interesting in that you're getting that just with the men. And so we men, we get our Y chromosomes just from our dads. And so you can look at the males in the population and actually look at the rate at which that Y chromosome is changing with respect to time to get an estimate of how far back you got to go to get to the first man. Now, one reason why these mitochondrial DNA studies are considered to be reasonable estimates that the first woman lived, say, 60,000 to about 230,000 years ago, is you're getting roughly the same dates when you look at the Y chromosome. They're coming into the same range. Now, big assumptions on all of them, but the fact that you're using three different methods and you're getting roughly the same dates with all the methods tells us we're probably in that ballpark. But if you were here a month ago, we also made the point those are upper limits because involved in all those methods are not only statistical errors, but systematic errors. But I'd argue that, yes, they may be upper limits, but we're probably only going to be able to shave off maybe 30 to 50,000 years. You're still getting a date a whole lot farther back in time than 6,000 years ago. And hey, we already had a study here making the point, there's no way the genealogies in the Bible give you an accurate date for when Adam and Eve lived or for when Noah lived. As we made the point, even if you assume there's no gaps in the genealogy, if you start with Adam and use the biblical genealogies to get to Noah, you get a different date than if you start with Abraham and work back to Noah. And the two dates differ by 110 years. That in itself is evidence that it's incorrect to assume that the genealogies are exhaustive. Every genealogy in the Bible has missing names.
Okay. Thomas Longo. Dr. Ross, what are your thoughts on Dr. Michael Heiser's premise in Unseen World and Reversing Hermann?
Yeah, Michael Heiser, he passed away a couple of months ago. He is a theologian, and he's most famous for writing books on the angelic realm. I've actually been on the platform with him at different events, particularly when we've been speaking about UFOs, UAPs, and extraterrestrial life. So I think he makes a good point, Michael, that Americans especially have not given enough attention to what the Bible says about angels. In fact, a lot of American Christians live their lives as if angels don't exist at all. And so he's been writing books making the point that there is this unseen realm, there are angels, as we see in Hebrews 13:2, referring to followers of Jesus Christ, many of them have entertained angels unawares. Now, where he and I do agree is that the righteous angels are sent by God to assist Christ's followers in their ministry. But when they come into our lives, they tend to intervene for a few seconds or a few minutes. We see examples of this in the book of Acts, where God sends an angel, for example, and releases Peter from prison. The angel is there to set him free, but as soon as he's set free, the angel disappears. So typically, they intervene at crucial points for a few seconds, for a few minutes, to assist us in our ministries. Now, the fallen angels, The unrighteous or wicked angels, the demons, they tend to come into the lives of unbelievers and they hang around for more than a few minutes or a few seconds. They can actually impact somebody's life throughout their entire lifetime. So they tend to hang around. Now, where Michael and I hold a different position, I think he gives way too much credence to the activity of angels and puts them at too high of a position of authority. He actually claims that the righteous angels are partnering with God at a level that I don't think the Bible would agree. Particularly Hebrews makes the point that Christ is not a mere angel, that he's way more powerful than the angels, and that God does not share his authority. So Michael is famous for talking about this grand council of angelic beings that are there with God at creation, partnering with him in creation. But the book of Isaiah is quite clear. There's only one creator. God does not share that anyone. That's exclusively God's role. So that's probably one area where we would differ. But I do compliment him for the fact that, hey, he's waking Americans up to the fact the angelic realm is real. We need to pay attention to it. And the angels really are, righteous angels, really are assisting God's people in their ministries. Hey, anybody who's here in person want to ask a question? If not, we'll go to another online question.
We got plenty of online. Susan Lamb, RN.
Yeah, Susan Lambeau. Yeah.
Yeah. How long after a supernova would we expect lifespans to be affected by the cosmic rays?
Okay, how long after a supernova? Well, it depends how close the supernova is. What Wolfendale and Ehrlichman are arguing is we're looking for a supernova that's probably a few hundred light years away at the time that it erupted. Now, given the movement of stars in our galaxy, it's probably more distant than that today. By the time of its eruption, it would have been that close. If you put it 10 light years away, it'll kill you. So, but if you put it, say, 100 light years away, it shortens your lifespan. If you put it, say, 200 light years away, it would shorten your lifespan at a less rapid rate. Now, I can't answer Susan's question with much precision because we astronomers haven't actually done experiments looking at nearby supernova and measuring the impact they have on our life because the supernova we can measure in human history are all 5,000 light years away or more distant, which means they really don't do much to affecting our lifespan. But the one identified by Ehrlichman and Wolfendale indeed would have an impact on our lifespan. But because we don't know how close it was at the time it erupted with any great precision, it's hard to put an exact number on it. And so there's a debate. Is it possible that these cosmic rays, killer cosmic rays from that supernova, have a bigger impact than the fact that ancient peoples weren't exposed to igneous rocks as much as we are? That's still up there. Both of them would have contributed to a significant degree.
Okay. John's got a question for you.
So I have a question and a comment. So the comment is that I've seen young Earth creationists frame their argument as biblical creation. And I thought that was interesting because they attack our position or the old Earth position as being unbiblical. But my question is that I've seen somebody argue that the part where in the creation account where God sees it and then it's good as being kind of like a allusion to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, where you know, you can't really know what it is, or it kind of changes properties as you observe it. I was wondering if you've ever heard that.
Yeah, I have, but it's quite easy to respond to. The Heisenberg uncertainty brings uncertainty into what you can see at the quantum level or the particle level. But, you know, so if you've got 1,000 different atomic particles, there's an uncertainty either both the position of the particle or the energy level of that particle. And it can be quite big. So for example, if you choose to measure with precision the energy level of a quantum particle, the uncertainty in its position is about plus or minus a third of a mile. So it's a big uncertainty. But if you've got 1,000 particles and average the positions and the energies of all those particles, you get a very accurate number. So if you've got enough particles, it'll average out. And hey, even if you only have 1,000 particles, they average out to a degree where the uncertainty virtually disappears. And so if you're talking the trillion cells in our human body, yeah, with that many cells and with a quadrillion of fundamental particles making up those cells, the uncertainty has weighed down probably around 40 places of the decimal. So the uncertainty is basically missing. There is no uncertainty. So there's no uncertainty about the age of the universe. None that you can blame on quantum mechanics. There's zero.
I've also heard that it was like, because it was formless and void, it's kind of like a cement mixer, where you know it's going to be a house, but in the mixer it's just kind of like cement. But the uncertainty was that before it was observed, it was something different than after it was observed.
Yeah, what do you do with the formless and void in Genesis 1-2? What impressed me the first time I picked up a Bible in my teenage years, as I looked at Genesis 1, it says, hey, this perfectly follows the scientific method. You look at Genesis 1, the first thing it tells you is the point of view from which you're to interpret the creation account, namely the surface of Earth's waters. Step 2 of the scientific method, don't interpret until you also identify the starting conditions. Genesis 1-2 gives you 4 starting conditions. It says it's dark on the surface of the waters, the water covers the whole surface of the earth, and it's formless and void. Now those two words, tohu wobohu in the Hebrew, what does it actually mean? Okay, it's basically saying the earth at that time is ruined and unfit, or formless and unfit. Well, what's the Genesis text all about? The Genesis text is all about God transforming the earth so he can fill it with life. So it's basically saying the earth has a form that's unfit for life and it's empty of life. But now God begins to create. He begins to transform the earth in such a way that it can be fit for life and filled for life. So I don't see it as referring to any change in the laws of physics. And the argument I give there is look at all the Bible passages that explicitly state the laws of physics are immutable, especially Jeremiah 33, where God says, I'm a God that doesn't change. I'm immutable. As proof, look at the laws that govern the heavens and the earth. As they don't change, I don't change. So it's basically telling us we can trust the laws of physics. And if we couldn't trust the laws of physics, we couldn't do science. Science is based on the fact that we can trust in the constancy of the laws of physics. Therefore, our measurements actually give us revelations into the true state of the system we're looking at. If the laws of physics were changing, forget about becoming a scientist. Nothing you would measure could be trustworthy. But the Bible is saying you can trust your measurements. And on that basis, it's no accident that the scientific revolution exploded out of Reformation Europe. If you look at other religions, they had scientific sparks, but in every case, that spark of scientific discovery was stillborn. It quickly got snuffed out. It was only in the Christian context, based on the Bible saying, you can really trust what you see and measure in nature. You can really trust the laws of physics, that people said, okay, we can actually learn about nature. And the Bible actually gives you the scientific method. So I actually refer to what you see in Genesis 1 as the biblical testing method. And that's what launched the scientific revolution. So to me, what was commendable about the Protestant Reformation, it's basically saying, you don't need a priest. Everyone is a priest. Everyone can read the Bible and understand what it says. And so when you had this huge population of people reading the Bible for themselves, those with a scientific bent began to apply what they saw in the Bible, and that was the birth of the scientific revolution.
Thank you. Thank you.
Are you up to one more question?
One more question.
Okay, this is from Doug. The James Webb telescope may have discovered a brand new class of cosmic object, the black hole star. What do you know about that?
Well, I'm not too sure what he's referring to with a black hole star. So that may be in the news recently. I can tell you that stars can become black holes. And so there are several stars in our Milky Way galaxy that have gone through the burning cycle, they've gone through a supernova eruption, and because of that large mass of the star, it basically collapsed into a black hole. Now, what Doug could be referring to is what astronomers have been speculating about for a long time, that in the early universe, where you don't have any elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, it's possible for stars to form that are not just 100 times the mass of the sun. That's about the limit. If you got carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen in the universe, those elements prevent really big stars from forming. And the limit is 150 times the mass of the star of the sun. The practical limit is about 100 times the mass of the star of the sun. But astronomers have been writing papers for decades pointing out in the early universe, where all you got is hydrogen and helium, it's actually possible to have stars that are 1,000 times the mass of our sun, or 500 times the mass of our star of the sun. And with more than 1,000 times the mass of our star of the sun, that star will never ignite nuclear fusion. Or more accurately, before it can ignite nuclear fusion, it collapses into a black hole. So these are stars that never shine. They're so massive that they immediately collapse under their own gravity into a black hole. Now, it's possible Doug may be referring to something I've not seen yet, where the James Webb Space Telescope has discovered one of these supermassive stars that never shone and collapsed into a black hole. Or he may be referring to something I am familiar with, namely that we're seeing in the early universe galaxies that are only a half billion years old or a billion years old that have supermassive black holes in their core that are coming in at almost a billion times the mass of our star, the sun. And the only way that could happen is if that you have a lot of firstborn stars that are more than 1,000 times the mass of our star, the sun. Even a year and a half ago, there were papers published basically establishing we now know, thanks to the James Webb Space Telescope, that in the early universe, there are stars that are 500 to 1,500 times the mass of our star, the sun, and conceivably even 10,000 times the mass of our star, the sun. So that basically proves there will be these stars that become black holes before they shine. So, but if James Webb has actually discovered one of these things, I doubt that's the case. I don't think that James Webb's got the power to make that kind of discovery, but it certainly has the power to prove that stars that massive existed in the early universe. And if they existed, indeed, there are objects that are black holes that never became stars, or at least never became stars that could shine.
Okay. All right, thank you, and please close us in prayer now.
My pleasure. Father in heaven, we thank you for this day. We thank you every day you give us to serve you here on earth. I pray, Father, we would go away and be sensitive to opportunities that you're giving us through your Holy Spirit to minister and serve you in the way that you intend. So, Lord, I pray that you would fill us with grace, humility, and wisdom, that you keep us in your word and in prayer so that we can be sensitive to those opportunities that you provide. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.